Hello, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz from Wyoming Catholic College. Welcome to this, our second lecture in Points of Light in the Darkness, the Church in the 19th Century, a distance learning class. And I welcome, I should also say, to my home office where it's quiet and I can record these easily. These days, we're used to thinking of England and France as allies. I mean, they fought together in World War I and World War II. They were our allies in resisting Soviet dominance in Europe. Together, they built the Channel, allowing passengers from London to travel to Paris or from Paris to travel to London in a mere 2 hours and 16 minutes. I mean, we're all friends here, but you probably know it has not always been that way. Up till 1800, the kings and queens in England claimed that they were the sovereign kings and queens over France, and the two countries fought 28 wars from 1109 to the Napoleonic defeat in 1815. Wars, needless to say, cost money, lots of money, and France had been at war with England from 1756 to 1763, and then it started again in 1778 through 1783. That last stretch had to do with France's involvement in the American War for Independence. By 1786, please note that date, by 1786, between the cost of wars and the lack of resolve and leadership skills on the part of the king, Louis XVI, France had enormous foreign debts and teetered on the verge of bankruptcy. On top of that, there had been 20 years of agricultural problems. Drought led to poor harvests, led to inflationary food prices, particularly the price of bread, led to unrest among the poor in the towns, country, and the villages, led to strikes, led to riots, led to looting. In 1786, Louis's controller general proposed a financial overhaul, including a land tax on all lands, regardless of who owned them. Strange to our ears, up till then, only the poor had been taxed for their land. The rich had been exempted from ad valorem taxes. The reform package proposed such large reforms that rather than summoning the Estates General in 1786, a meeting was scheduled for 1789. Now you can imagine that the clergy, the nobles, and the middle class that made up the Estates General and would bear the brunt of the reforms that had to be convinced that this was a good idea, and that would take years. But once 1789 came around, King Louis, the clergy, the nobles, and the middle class had more to worry about than a tax increase. The clergy, called the First Estate, and the nobles, the Second Estate, in the Estates General, managed to alienate the middle class, that is, the Third Estate, angering them and radicalizing them. The Third Estate left the Estates General, reconstituting the National Assembly and standing up to the king and the others. On July 14th, 1789, angered by the king's treatment of the assembly, a mob stormed the Bastille, a prison in Paris. And while there were only seven prisoners there to set free, there was a vast quantity of gunpowder, which was the actual objective. And thus began the French Revolution. The financial crisis of 1786 had not been solved. Cash-strapped France needed money, and at least assets that could be turned into money, like all the church's property. In October 1789, the assembly passed a law placing, quote, all ecclesiastical property at the disposal of the nation, close quote. This, as one delegate declared, was both to avoid bankruptcy and to, quote, destroy the clerical order, close quote, thus improving equity in France. The church promptly lost every source of income she had. since giving to the church had already been abolished. In addition, the state went from property to people, suspending all monastic vows and abolishing most monasteries. In 1790, the state reorganized the church, effectively taking over. The clergy were forced to swear an oath to the state as their highest authority. Then in 1793, the Reign of Terror began, and in the name of reason, freedom, and equity, the streets ran with blood. In November of that year, all still existing churches and chapels were secularized. Clergy who had not sworn an oath were liable to the death penalty, and clergy who had sworn an oath were not exactly safe. War had been declared on Christ and his church, all in the name of reason. In his book, Triumph, The Power and Glory of the Catholic Church, H.W. Crocker III sums it up this way. There is, in the French Revolution, a horrible vein of murderous utilitarianism, of ideology trumping humanity, of the need of the state being paramount, of hatred and depravity unleashed in the name of a higher purpose, which remains an uncomfortable common streak in modern man. Now, while the Reign of Terror ended in July 1794, the reason-driven madness continued until Napoleon Bonaparte seized power in 1799. He slowly, over time, gave the church some breathing room carefully defined by Napoleon Bonaparte and reluctantly agreed to by Pope Pius VII in the Concordat of 1801. By 1805, churches across France were again reopened. Excuse me. Understand that the church in France had been settling on its lees since long before the Revolution. It was not a healthy church to begin with. Then along came the Revolution that closed the churches, hunted and executed clergy, changed public morality, and prevented the teaching of the faith. This went on for more than 15 years. As you would guess, Christianity in France was an utter mess as a result. Which brings me back to 1786. On May 8th of that year, something very ordinary and seemingly insignificant occurred. In a little town, a little nowhere town, called Dardilly, in the wine region near Lyon, a baby boy was born. The fourth of what would be the six children of Matthew and Marie, pious Catholics, who had him baptized the same day, giving him the name Jean-Baptiste Marie Vianney. We know him today as Saint John Vianney, cure of Ars, the patron saint of priests. 4 years after his birth, the terror began. The French philosopher Denis Diderot, who lived 1713 through 1784, had written, quote, "Man will only be free when the last king is strangled with the entrails of the last priest," close quote. The terror was Diderot's comment come to life. The revolutionary Republican government declared mass illegal, closed parish churches and drove the priests who they didn't kill into hiding. Well, you could still go to mass if you could find it, and clandestine masses were celebrated in outlying farmhouses or barns by priests who were always on the run. Well, legal or illegal, Matthew and Marie Vianney took their family to mass. They befriended two nuns whose convent had been disbanded and emptied by the revolution. The two sisters catechized the Vianney children, and John received First Communion when he was 13. The mass was held in a neighbor's kitchen, the priest on the run, and the windows covered from prying eyes that might see candles burning. John was apparently pious from a young age and watched the priests defy the laws of France to bring the gospel and the sacraments to God's people. This so inspired him that it gave him a desire to join their ranks. He would be a priest as well, even if that meant risking his life. In 1806, when John was 20, his father, a farmer and shepherd, permitted him to leave the farm for a nearby school run by a certain Abbé Bélay. At school, John studied arithmetic, history, geography, and the bane of his existence, Latin. He was a very poor Latin student in an age when you needed to know Latin in order to be a priest. 3 years later, he was drafted. Napoleon wanted to invade Spain, and that required more soldiers. Well, whether it was due to a clerical error or because Napoleon didn't care about those studying for the priesthood, Jean Vianney was drafted. Now, this began kind of a comedy of errors. John reported to his unit and promptly got sick. They headed off to war without him and left him convalescing. Once he was healthy again, he was assigned to a different unit and reported as ordered. Knowing that his unit was moving out soon, John retired to the local parish church to pray. And when he emerged from the church, his unit was gone. They moved out, and he was left behind. Well, what to do? As he pondered, he met someone who said he knew where the soldiers had gone and would guide him safely to his unit. Instead, he led John to a village deep in the mountains, a village that was a favorite spot for military deserters. And while not intending to be a deserter, that's just what he was. He stayed with a widow named Claudine Fayot, and, beginning with her four children, started a village school. During the winter, travel in the mountains was so treacherous that he was safe, nobody coming to look for him. But when spring arrived, so did the posses searching for deserters. Vianney, to hide his identity, went by the name Jerome Vincent, and often hid in haystacks to avoid detection. Fortunately for John, as well as for countless other people during his lifetime and far beyond, including us, in 1810, Napoleon granted amnesty to all deserters, allowing John to return home and go back to school. In 1812, he went to a minor seminary. In 1813, to a major seminary, but unable to keep up with his studies, it was the Latin, he went back to Abbé Bélay. Bélay realized that Vianney was no Thomas Aquinas, but he also realized that what Jean Vianney lacked in intellect and scholarship, he more than made up for in piety. Thus, with Bélay's help, Vianney was ordained to the priesthood on August 12, 1815, and his first assignment was to assist Bélay. When Bélay died in 1818, everyone assumed Vianney would succeed his mentor in what was a fairly prominent parish in a good-sized city. Instead, Vianney was assigned to Ars, a rural village of about 230 people. That is, he was assigned to a no place, a village so tiny, so obscure, that as the new priest headed to the village, he got lost and had to ask directions. It was so hard to find. Not only that, but as he prepared to go to Ars, the vicar general of his diocese wished him well and then added, "My friend, you are going to a small parish where very little of the love of God can be seen. You are now to enkindle the flame of divine charity there. Think about what he faced. For 12 years, from 1793 to 1805, the churches were boarded up and closed, if not converted into some other use. Those who practiced the faith were in fear of their life. The revolutionary calendar had 10-day weeks instead of 7-day weeks. There was no Sabbath, no Lord's Day, no Mass. Oh, there was a day off every 10 days, but it wasn't the same. If you went to Mass and were caught, the priest would be executed and you might be as well. People found other, safer things to do with their time. Since ours was an agricultural community, on Sunday, as it was on all days, there was plenty of work to be done. And besides, the tavern was open with plenty of adult beverages. Remember, this was a wine-growing region, and music for dancing. Now, it's not clear to me what exactly the dancing looked like in ours, but Vianney's vehement disapproval of dancing indicates that if the dancing itself wasn't immoral, the point of the dancing was immoral. That is, it led to fornication or adultery. In ours, few people were in the habit of showing up for Mass on Sunday. The anti-clericalism of the Revolution still hung in the air. And after all those years, ignorance of the faith and indifference to the things of God characterized most of the French people. And John Vianney was called, quote, to enkindle the flame of divine charity. Wow, good luck with that. John Vianney served in ours more than 40 years until his death in 1859. Oh my God, he wrote, grant me the conversion of my parish. I consent to suffer whatever you wish for as long as I live. And God granted his prayer. The parish was converted. Not only that, tens of thousands of others were converted through the life, the prayers, the labors, the penance, and the intense suffering of Father John Vianney. In his encyclical, Sacerdotii Nostri Primorda, from the beginning of our priesthood, Pope St. John the 23rd wrote, quote, you cannot begin to speak of St. John Murray Vianney without automatically calling to mind the picture of a priest who was outstanding in a unique way in voluntary affliction of his body. His only motives were the love of God and the desire for the salvation of the souls of his neighbors. And this led him to abstain almost completely from food and from sleep, to carry out the harshest kinds of penances, and to deny himself with great strength of soul. Close quote. Vianney was a Third Order Dominican and lived the kind of ascetic life St. Francis did, in poverty, chastity, and obedience. My secret, he wrote, is easy to learn. It can be summed up in these few words: give everything away and keep nothing for yourself. He lived a life of poverty in threadbare clothes and the simplest of food. His typical meal was a stale piece of bread and a glass of milk, sometimes supplemented with a cold potato that had been boiled for him by a nearby woman. It was just one of the harsh ways he treated his body. He further showed self-denial in his obedience. More than once, as he got older, he asked to be relieved of the burden of parish life and to retire to a monastery to live a solitary life, the kind of life he'd always desired. But by that time, ours had become a pilgrimage destination, Tens of thousands came to confess their sins to Father Vianney and to hear his counsel, sometimes waiting more than 24 hours for a turn in the confessional. Gosh, we have to wait more than 24 minutes. We go berserk. 24 hours. His bishop never granted his request for relief. This was God's way, we're told, of bending St. Jean-Marie Vianney's will to obedience and of teaching him to put the duties of his office before his own desires. And so there was never a time when his devotion to self-denial did not shine forth. Close quote. His self-denial shone most brightly in his devotion to the sacrament of reconciliation. Confession, he knew, was the engine of renewal. Pope St. John Paul III wrote of Vianney, quote, "Without the step of conversion, penance, and seeking pardon that the Church's ministers ought untiringly to encourage and welcome, the much-desired renewal will remain superficial and illusory." Evangelical church historian and expert on the history of revivals and renewals, Dr. Richard Lovelace, wrote in his book, The Dynamics of Spiritual Life, that there are two preconditions to all spiritual renewals, whether they be Protestant or Catholic or Orthodox. First, the awareness of the holiness of God, and second, the awareness of the depth of our sin. That was John Vianney's secret. Reading his sermons is quite an experience. He was, you could say, a hellfire and brimstone preacher. Let me give you an example. Talking about what he calls a bad death, he says that dying young, for example, is not a bad death. What makes a bad death is sin. Quote, "Ah, this horrible sin which tears and devours at its dread moment. Alas, no matter where the poor unfortunate sinner looks, he sees only sin and neglected graces. If he lifts his eyes to heaven, he sees only an angry God, armed with all the fury of his justice, who is ready to punish him. If he turns his gaze downward, he sees only hell and its furies, already opening its gates to receive him. Alas, this poor sinner did not want to recognize the justice of God during his life on earth. At this moment, not only does he see it, but he feels it already pressing down upon him. During his lifetime, he was always trying to hide his sins, or at least to make as little of them as possible. But at this moment, everything is shown to him as in the broad light of day. He sees now what he should have seen before. What he did not want to see, he would like to weep for his sins, but he has no more time. He scorned God during his lifetime. God now, in his turn, scorns him and abandons him to his despair." John Vianney was serious about the conversion of sinners, and thus he was serious about sin and its remedy. Turning to Jesus in confession and repentance. Father John Vianney spent 10 to 15 hours a day hearing confessions. That was a solution for sin. Hearing confessions and giving absolution and suffering with and for his people. Filling up, as St. Paul wrote in Colossians 1:24, filling up what was lacking in regard to Christ's afflictions. The church in ours, of course, had neither central heating nor central air conditioning. In the winter, Vianney endured frigid cold with inadequate clothing. He said that upon leaving the confessional in winter, He looked for his feet, making sure they were still there, because he couldn't feel them anymore. In the summer, he endured heat and bad air in the confessional, and no doubt the body odor and bad breath of the penitents. In every season, he emerged from the confessional, cramped, sore, stiff, and bent over. St. John Paul II explains, "For him, this was undoubtedly the greatest of his mortifications, a form of martyrdom. In the first place, it was a martyrdom in the physical sense, from the heat, the cold, or the suffocating atmosphere. Second, in the moral sense, for he himself suffered from the sins confessed, and even more, the lack of repentance. I weep because you do not weep," he said. In the face of these indifferent people, whom he welcomed as best he could, and tried to awaken in them the love of God, the Lord enabled him to reconcile great sinners who were repentant, and also to guide to perfection souls thirsting for it. It was here, above all, that God asked him to share in the redemption." Close quote. Vianney said, quote, "I pine away with melancholy on this wretched earth. My soul is sad even unto death. My ears hear nothing but painful things that break my heart with grief." Through it all, John Vianney lived a life of purity that you could see. St. John the 23rd wrote, "It is said that the face of the pastor of ours shone with an angelic purity." It was said that even outside of the confessional, he could talk with someone and tell him what his sins were. While the persecutions and murders of the terror went away and the churches reopened, France in the early 1800s was less than receptive to the gospel. In 1826, a Viscount observed, quote, "Indifference to religion, hatred of the priest, were the symptoms of the revolution. God grant that the same things do not bring the same results. The unfortunate priests no longer dare to go through the streets. They are everywhere insulted. 3 days since, a well-dressed man passing by the Sentinel of Luxembourg said to him, pointing to a priest, 'Never mind, in a year you'll see no more of all those wretches.' The poor cure of Cligny was in real danger, surrounded by 200 or 300 madmen who cried, 'Down with the black hats!' Every day there is a scene of the same sort." And yet, it was reported that typically about 20,000 people came each year to the little nowhere hamlet of ours. In 1856, it's said that there were 80,000 who came. There, a tired, bent old priest, weary from years of prayer, fasting, penance, and ministry, heard their confessions, offered them counsel in the conversion of their hearts, and absolved their sins. In a column at The Catholic Thing, Michael Pakulik quoted St. Jose Maria Escriva, "These world crises are crises of saints." Then Pakulik went on, quote, "Yet although saints are the answer to crises, they do not aspire to be answers to crises. Nor arguably could they become saints if they did. They aspire to love God passionately, regardless of crises. Close quote. St. John Vianney was a bright point of light in a particularly dark and deeply anti-Christian era of history. He loved God passionately, and the only crisis he was interested in solving was the crisis of unbelief in the life of each repentant sinner who came to him and sat, who came to him as he sat crammed into a confessional, a bright light amid a crooked and corrupt generation. Next week, we'll cross the channel and consider the conditions surrounding the life of St. John Henry Newman and God's work through another amazing point of light. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.